Welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to become a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Fittock, Managing Partner at Tomorrow Brands, a consultancy that helps launch the global brands of tomorrow in the UK. Today, I'm joined by Charlie Gent, founder of Mission Kitchen, a workspace for food founders. We talk about creating spaces for innovation, entrepreneurship, the power of community, and much more. Before we start, it'd be great to hear a bit more about your background and what you do at Mission Kitchen.
Thank you for having me on. I started out originally in advertising, so my first job was working as a strategist in a big international advertising agency, and I found myself predominantly working on food brands. So my big clients were McDonald's and Kellogg's. So I spent, for my sins, most of my 20s helping them sell lots of breakfast cereal and burgers. After a few years of that, I became a bit disillusioned with the work that I was doing and the kind of businesses that I was doing it for, but also just being in such big organizations and working with such big clients, being very divorced from the actual end consumers and the results of what I was spending my time doing. But the idea for Mission Kitchen really emerged from one of those classic stories of someone trying to solve their own problem. Alongside my day job, I've always loved food. I've always cooked constantly, and I wanted to start a food business as a side hustle, like a fun project alongside my day job. But I was living in a rented flat with two housemates. I didn't have anywhere else I could go to actually make the food I wanted to sell. And because of the world that I worked in, I just assumed there would be a place that you go to if you want to get started as a food entrepreneur, but discovered that there wasn't, or in the UK, there wasn't. In that research, found some examples in the US of really interesting projects that were creating these incubator spaces for food brands. And that was really the inspiration that set us off on the journey to try and bring Mission Kitchen to life. And Mission Kitchen, to give a bit of background on what it is and what we do, Mission Kitchen is an incubator for food and drink startups. We run a site in London that accommodates a community of about 100, normally just over 100 food and drink businesses. We provide them with access to commercial kitchen space, co-working space, and all the normal kind of meeting rooms and event spaces and things that come with it, and a program of business support. So we offer mentorship, advisory support, learning events, opportunities to meet with buyers, and really anything we can do to build the support and opportunities around our space to support the community of entrepreneurs who we're working with.
Is your side hustle food brand still going?
It's never taken off. I've still got it up my sleeve, so you never know.
You've got all the resources.
Mission Kitchen doesn't work out. You never know. I might go back to it.
So I've been to the space and it's bustling, it's lively, it smells amazing, as you can imagine. So you have brands from the very early stages, and then at some point they'll leave, will they, and spread their wings. You are a incubator.
Yeah, exactly. We describe ourselves as an incubator, and that's how we feel about it. We exist to really support people through that first phase of growth, from concept through to the point where they're really ready to start scaling. So it really varies, but we have entrepreneurs who join us from pre-concept, even when they're really still just playing around with different ideas. And generally, we aim to support them from that stage through to the point where, either if they're an FMCG brand, generally at the point where they're really ready to start working with major retailers, scaling their manufacturing significantly, that's the point at which they'll generally move on from Mission Kitchen. Equally, we work with brands more in the kind of hospitality and food service space as well. So they might be street food brands or people who are bakers or confectionery brands. And on that side of the industry, it's more when people are ready to take on their own premises. So they'll, you know, work with us to grow their business to the point where they're ready to take on a commercial lease and, you know, start their operation full time out there in the big bad world.
So what is working and what's not in 2025, or on the back of a few crazy years? What are the biggest challenges and opportunities brands are seeing?
I think we've had over 300 businesses who have come through our community, and equally we probably get 1,000 inquiries about membership a year that we're seeing. Wow. Even if they don't end up joining Mission Kitchen, we're seeing and speaking to so many businesses. So we do get a really interesting perspective into the ecosystem and what's happening. I guess what that shows us, firstly, is that there is no shortage of amazing ideas, really talented people who have got amazing products, great concepts, increasingly the ability to tell really great stories about those products and where they've come from. So there's no, we're oversupplied with talent, I think, in the industry, and opportunities and ideas. As you say, it's a challenging time. The last few years have really put pressure, I think, on that startup ecosystem, that cost of business is going up and discretionary spending is going down, and it's making it harder and harder for people to turn those great ideas into truly sustainable businesses. I guess that's where we try and step in. I think the biggest challenge is generally technical. I think for people to work out how to turn a great recipe or a great idea into a product that is truly scalable, something that can be produced consistently, safely, cheaply, at high volumes, requires a lot of insight and knowledge that your average person stepping into the industry doesn't have. So unlocking that technical expertise, I think, is one of the biggest challenges that founders face. Connected to that, I think, is another big barrier is just financial. People need to really wrestle with their financial models at the very early stages, I think. Working out their costing, working out their pricing, working out their margin structures, really getting to grips with their supply chain and putting themselves in a position at an early stage where they have the foundations for a business that can then grow. I think that's something we see a lot of early stage founders struggling with or skipping at the start and just being like, I'll work that out later. And it's really hard to work out later. So wrestling with those tricky challenges around your cost base and your pricing strategy, I think, is really important at an early stage. And then the last thing, I think, is really around social capital. We have a really big focus at Mission Kitchen on inclusivity and diversity, taking advantage of the amazing position that food and drink has to offer opportunities for self-employment and entrepreneurship to people from really diverse backgrounds and all walks of life. But that also comes with challenges because it's an industry where you really need to know the right people to succeed. And whether that's getting access to retailers or getting access to investors, that network is super important. And again, some people come into the industry with that network already existing, but many don't. Finding ways to build that network, connect with the kind of gatekeepers and the people that you need to be on your side for your brand to grow, is really important. And again, it's something that we try and help people with, but there's lots of other people out in the industry as well who are helping early stage founders navigate that.
And do you think, just thinking back to, you're talking about operational, is there, when you're meeting all of these founders and all this amazing talent that you mentioned, are there any common threads on the type of people they are, the type of backgrounds that they have? Because I have to say, my immediate reaction to that is that's the boring stuff. And I know there are lots of people who do not find that stuff boring. Those people are very important to our industry. But as a brand and marketing person, I tend to be in that camp. Is that a common thing, would you say?
It is a real mixed bag. And people from all different professional backgrounds, people of all ages. So it's very varied in terms of the founder profile. But I would say, yeah, it definitely skews in the same direction that you find yourself in, I think. The vast majority of people who are starting these businesses are starting them out of a love of food, an amazing family recipe that's been handed down that they want to celebrate. They're creative people generally. And we have had brands who come through who are founded by technical founders and people with real expertise, but it's definitely a much smaller segment. And most people are the people who are coming in with real passion for something and they want to focus on the food, focus on the brand, focus on the stories. And yeah, forcing them to get to grips with the complicated technical stuff is really important.
And it's really interesting when you launched, I guess you've been going 3 years, we were just coming out of that funny COVID time when there were no real shared spaces where people could get together and people were creating things at their home on their own behind computer screens. So I'd love to hear about what you think physical space means and the impact that you've seen.
Yeah, there are two elements to that, I suppose. One is food has a very physical requirement. Things need to be made. So access to facilities to do that has always been essential. The key thing that we offer, and probably the reason that 90% of our members will join us, is to solve a practical physical challenge that they need space and equipment with which to manufacture. And obviously that's always required facilities to do it. And I think the key difference that comes through a shared space is the impact that has on affordability. Because we're creating a space that's shared by hundreds of businesses, it makes it a lot more affordable and a lot more flexible for people. And in those early stages, that's so important. If you can reduce your startup costs and manage your cash flow more closely in the early days, it can have a massive impact in the long run. That allows you to delay that point at which you need to take on external money, or allows you to build more traction with your brand before you need to really take on a bigger cost base. It can make a huge difference. But equally important, and probably more important actually, is the community element of just being around other entrepreneurs. I think people join Mission Kitchen because they want to use our kitchens, but the reason they stay with us is because they get to connect with 100 other entrepreneurs and learn from them and share with them. And that, I think, can only really happen in real life and in person. Those kind of relationships that get formed between people who are working around each other day in, day out, go really deep. As I say, a big part of what we're trying to do is build networks and help people build their social capital. And I think people think of food as a really sociable, connected industry. But the reality is, for most people, it's not like that. It can be quite isolated and quite isolating. People spend a lot of time working stuff out on their own and working independently alone on really complicated things. And I think what community, whether it's Mission Kitchen or other forms of community, I think what's really valuable is the opportunity to just share knowledge with people who are going through similar experiences. And for us, I think it's very reassuring for our members to think almost whatever problem you're wrestling with or challenge you've got or question you have, chances are there's someone else in the community who's recently answered that question or can offer you some advice on how to do it. So I think that's maybe the superpower of the community, is just having all of those people together in one place. And we do a lot of work to foster that community actively.
Yeah, and it's tricky, isn't it? If you're going from full-time employment and being part of a team to suddenly doing something on your own. And if a lot of people, when they're starting out at the very beginning, they're on their own, you don't have the budget or even the requirements for a team of people. And that's a very big jump, though, going from being within a business, having lots of people around you, to having a business. It's a very different mindset, and you're having to work through problems a lot of the time. And I think it can feel quite isolating.
Definitely. And with the stage of businesses that we're working with, a lot of them are solo entrepreneurs still at this point, so sole founders. And those that do have teams, they are small teams. So I absolutely agree. I think that being able to rely on the community to provide you with that kind of both technical and practical business support of like information that's out there. But as you say, equally important is just the emotional support, just like other people who you can have a moan with, who you can do a bit of therapy for each other. Just having people to talk to about the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur, yeah, it's really important.
So how are you seeing the market change? How are brands testing ideas faster? The UK retail scene can be very tough to break. Are you seeing any innovative approaches?
It's interesting. You mentioned earlier, you know, when the timing that Mission Kitchen opened, which as you say was just after the pandemic. We were meant to open in 2020, like everyone else, had a few disruptions that year.
That's a big one for you guys. There's no real workaround there.
So we didn't open in 2020. We opened in 2021, in the summer of 2021, which was a really interesting time to open. Firstly, because there had been such an explosion in the number of micro businesses in food and drink during the pandemic, with so many people at home, so many people working in the food sector on furlough or redundant, starting new projects during lockdown, and then many of them deciding to, during that 12 months before we opened, when the world was going through this bizarre change, the whole startup ecosystem redesigned itself as food became something that you sold online and you delivered to your customers. And there were examples, obviously, of direct consumer brands before the pandemic, and people were using online sales as part of their sales mix. Things shifted so dramatically during that time, and it opened up so many new ways for brands to do business by selling to their customers directly and transacting online. Obviously, things have shifted back, and the pathways to retail have become really important again. A lot of what was learned during that time and a lot of the tactics that people were using that time are still really important and valuable today. So we see that with our community, that often when they're first starting out, that online and direct consumer sales channel will be their only or their primary source of business. But even as they grow, increasingly they're retaining that as a really important part of their sales mix and something that can position them really well when it comes to the conversations that they have to have with retailers further down the line. That approach allows you to do that are putting brands in really strong positions. The first of which is like audience building, like going beyond audience actually to community building. There's a really great essay that was written years and years ago, I think, by a guy called Kevin Kelly, who's, I think he was like the founder of Wired magazine or something. He's a tech commentator from Silicon Valley. But he wrote this really great essay called 1,000 True Fans. And the thrust of it was basically, it's more valuable for you to have 1,000 true fans, people who really love your business, than it is for you to have 1 million transactional customers. And if you can build an audience that are loyal, that are going to repeat purchase, who are going to be advocates for your brand, and who you can have direct relationships with to get feedback from, learn, iterate, and improve your product, that is gold dust. And I think the brands who are doing online direct consumer well and are building really deep relationships with a small group of real fans, that is so valuable for them, both as they develop their product, develop their brand, but as they build their business. And that was something that wasn't really available or done in the same way previously. So I think that's really important. I think we often talk about how small businesses can operate in a market that is dominated by enormous businesses. And the big incumbents, the big brands and the big retailers, all these people, there's so many advantages that come with their scale and their size. But there's also amazing advantages that come with being really small. And as people are just starting out and they're really trying to navigate the first few years of their growth, I think it's about thinking hard about that. What are the things that a small business can do that a big business can't? If you've got a smaller number of customers, you can have a really intimate relationship with them. You can surprise and delight them so much more easily. You can do things that aren't scalable to really build those relationships and leverage them. You have opportunities to act quickly, to iterate, to respond to things that you're learning or seeing in the market that big businesses aren't able to do. You can be much more agile. And yeah, I think leaning into those things and thinking about what you can do as a small brand that the big category or brand that you're aiming to disrupt can't do is really helpful. And I think if people do that, if they lean into these things and they try and build loyal communities, they try and take advantage of the opportunity that they have to test and iterate and improve their product, if they can build traction organically and independently, I still believe that for the vast majority of these kind of businesses, at some point, they're going to have to engage with the gatekeepers of the industry. They're going to have to work with the larger retailers. They're going to have to take on external funding. There are some examples of people who have managed to bypass that completely and just become amazing direct consumer brands who have just grown organically. Amazing and probably an envious business model to have, but it's really difficult. But for those who are going to ultimately go down the path of major retail and taking on investment, being in a position where you're doing that on your own terms and you have a really strong foundation of your business, you've learned and tested lots of times, you've got a customer base that is loyal and advocating for you already, it gives you the freedom and the opportunity to engage in those conversations at the right time and with the confidence that you're using them to help you grow your business. And I think that's really powerful.
You've got proof of concept at that point, haven't you? You've got something tangible that you can take to investors, that you can take to retailers. You can say, we have all of these fans. That's a rare thing. I think there's an expression that I love, and I can't remember where I first heard it, but it's become sort of my own mantra, which is test, learn, pivot, grow. And I think when you're starting something new, that's what you're continually doing, and you're making those micro adjustments or even those bigger pivots. But you can only really do that once you've started and you're out in market, you're listening, you're asking questions, and you're hearing from those initial early adopters of your brand. So I think building that community, even if it's really small initially, because when you're starting something, what you think it is might not be what it is. It doesn't mean your idea is wrong. You need to let the market decide. So put it out there and you will find out quickly, if you do the right listening, where you've got it wrong. And then you've got the opportunity to adjust. You only really get that properly if you listen to what your audience are telling you.
If you look at the tech sector, they'll bang on endlessly about product market fit. Mm. And that's the objective, is working towards product market fit. And no one expects that the first thing that you design or conceive of is going to be the thing that works, but it's just a process that you work through to get there. And that kind of thinking applied in the food industry, I think, is really helpful. But also being in a position where you can work in that way. One of the big discussions that we have with businesses is around the idea of, this is in FMCG, scaling your own manufacturing capabilities or outsourcing manufacturing entirely to a third party, and the kind of pros and cons that come with each. But one of the big pros that come with developing your own manufacturing capabilities, or at least extending the time frame before you outsource, is that it allows you to be so much more responsive and so much more agile. If you're in control of your own manufacturing, then you can pivot and you can experiment and you can try new things in a way that once your manufacturing is being taken care of by someone else, it becomes much harder to do.
That's that expression, strong opinions loosely held as well, especially if you're a founder and you've got this idea for your brand and then the market tells you something that you might not want to hear. But if you're able to make adjustments in this early stage, you've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, something we say about Mission Kitchen is that our ambition and our aim is that every business who comes to Mission Kitchen succeeds and goes on to change the world. But the reality is that's not going to happen. Startups try and fail a lot. And something that we think is really important is a safe place to fail, a safe place to try and to fail. One of the reasons Mission Kitchen exists is to support more innovation generally in the industry. We want more ideas to emerge and we want them to disrupt the way things are done, and we want to introduce new concepts and ways of doing business. And that relies on people taking risks and trying new things. Traditionally, that can be a really risky thing to do. If you're taking on debt or if you're leasing a production facility, taking these big, scary commitments as an entrepreneur makes it very difficult for you to take risks and dissuades a lot of people from even trying. What we try and do is make things as flexible as possible so that people can try something out with relatively low commitment and relatively low risk. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And they aren't saddled with loads of debt and they don't have to run away with their tail between their legs. They can regroup and try again.
Yeah, we had someone on the podcast the other day, actually, and they said that there are VCs who specifically look for second-time founders to invest in, because by the time you're coming back, you've made a lot of mistakes. You're not going to make them again. And they're the best people to back because they know what they're doing. So all of that will be valuable experience, no matter how it pans out. So last few questions now. What do you think are the most exciting categories in food and drink?
As I say, we get a really interesting kind of cross-section and we get to see trends come and go through the volume of applications and inquiries and businesses that we speak to. Some of the interesting areas that we are seeing is around international foods and authenticity and regionality. It's really interesting. We have a very diverse community in terms of the cultures and ethnicities that make it up and the kind of food cultures that come with them. And I think there's a real interest at the minute in championing these recipes, flavors, ingredients in a much more specific way, in a much more kind of authentic way, talking about the provenance and origin of those foods, which is really interesting. In our community, we've got a few brands who are doing this in really different ways. There's one great brand who launched with us a few years ago called The Garden of Eva. She's a really inspiring founder, someone who was started at complete concept stage, didn't even have a product when we first met her, and now is stocked in Whole Foods and supplying elsewhere. But her products are condiments and pickles inspired by the American South. So through her experience growing up in the American South and products that you'd never have come across or heard of in the UK, but she's telling that story in a really vibrant way and it's really gathering traction. People, we have another business called Third Culture Cat, where the founder is sourcing chilies and other ingredients from Kashmir, where her heritage is, and developing really specific kind of regional interpretations of chili oils, hot sauces, chutneys, but really telling the stories of the farmers and the producers who are making those products and communicating that's a core part of the brand. So I think these kind of stories of people who are getting much more specific about the actual regions that these foods are coming from and breaking it down from, this isn't just like an Asian sauce or an Indian chutney. It's like, where actually specifically are these food traditions and who are the people that they're coming from? So I think that's a really interesting movement, is that kind of diversification of those kind of world food aisles into much more authentic, really interesting representations of food and food cultures that haven't been available in the UK so far. There's a few examples that I think of. I always hesitate to pick out brands from Mission Kitchen because
that's my next question.
Yeah, I'm always nervous about choosing any particular brands because it feels a bit like you're choosing your favorite of your children. But there are a few that I think represent some other interesting kind of just trends that we're seeing. So there's an amazing brand called All the Aunties. So Ria started out this concept for a paneer brand, but bringing Paneer into the 21st century, and brought that to us a year ago, probably, as a concept that she was developing. She came into the kitchen at Mission Kitchen to test recipes less than a year ago, I think. And the traction that she's built around that concept, the momentum she's built, has been amazing. So she's on the Tesco Accelerator program this year. She stopped in Whole Foods. The first launch of the actual product was at the moment that it went on the shelves at Whole Foods.
It's believable.
Yeah.
And also, just for the record, doesn't normally happen for anyone who's listening as an aspiring founder of a food brand.
No, but I think what it tells us is really interesting about possibly why that happened is that sits in such an interesting intersection of this point I was just talking about, of taking this kind of slightly unsung food stuff that is such a big part of the diet elsewhere in the world, but on the Indian subcontinent, but is rarely celebrated or shouted about in the UK, and presenting that in an entirely new way that's got this amazing brand story behind it, but is also positioning it really, I think, within this search for non-meat protein alternatives and natural foods. It's just a great, authentic, traditional product that's been given a 21st century makeover. So I think that's a really interesting one. We focus a lot on sustainability, and we really try and champion brands who are doing sustainable and circular things well. And there's a great example in our community called Nibs, etc., which is a upcycled food brand. So Chloe, the founder, started with a line of granolas, and she now has crackers and a pipeline of other products she's planning to bring online soon. The idea there is that they're repurposing waste streams from the fruit juice industry they use to develop and incorporate into these products to make granolas and crackers. So a really interesting story around circularity and sustainability. But most importantly, the product is amazing. It's the best tasting granola you'll find on the shelves. And I think that's really important with that world of sustainability claims and all these other areas where people are, you're building your brand around an ethical or sustainable claim. It's a waste of time if the product's not delicious, because people won't repeat buy for that reason alone. So I think that's a great example of someone who's doing a sustainable concept really well, because the focus on the product and its just quality is central to why it's on the trajectory that it is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's the same for Better For You as well. Unless you're at the very super healthy end of the market for most things, it's just all about taste, and that should be the objective. It's just got to be delicious, hasn't it? That's why we buy things, because they're enjoyable. It's why there's so much joy in food. It's got to taste great. And then you come back because it ticks all those boxes.
Yeah, I mean, we had a really interesting panel discussion event last year, end of last year, I think, which was all on the subject of sustainability. And we had Fergus, the founder of Nice Rice, on the panel, and Imogen, the founder of Northern Pasta Company, who are both doing a kind of innovation that I personally find really exciting and interesting, that's slightly different to some of the other things we're talking about. But that was their message. They were like, look, these businesses are built around a regenerative agriculture goal, but all you can focus on in terms of your brand really is taste and quality. It's like people are only going to pick up this off the shelf rather than the alternative if they're believing that it's going to be great, and then they're only going to keep coming back if it tastes as good as they thought.
One thing I do wonder about the regenerative claim is all this chat about heavily processed foods. That alone is delivering a kind of quality message in itself, because you hear it and you think that's a natural food, care's been taken over it. I wonder if that actually helps with taste perception in a way.
Yeah, that's an area that I think is the most interesting area of innovation in the industry. It is the innovation focused at these store cupboard staple ingredients. I think there are so many big challenges that the food sector faces and the world faces in relation to the food sector. And a new CBD kombucha is realistically not going to solve those challenges. And it's the foods that are in every cupboard at home and are eaten every day that present the biggest opportunity. So I find the businesses like Wild Farm, like Nice Rice, like Citizens of Soil, these people who are just focused on these core ingredients and how through supply chain innovation, we can find ways of delivering food that's better for the planet, better for people, and doing that in a way that's exciting and engaging is is really interesting. And I think that's where the biggest impact will come from, are people who are focusing those innovation efforts on the hardest things to innovate in, store cupboard staples.
The thing I love about all those brands, I've bought all of them, is these things we see as commodities. Once you start thinking about it and you understand where it comes from, it starts to make you feel differently about food, which I think is what everybody needs. I think we've gotten so far away from how food is made and where it comes from and how it's grown.
I think those businesses are great examples of what we talked about earlier around building community and building a kind of a movement behind them. Amelia at Bold Bean has done that amazingly. Wild Farm, Citizens of Soil, obviously they've lent so far into this subscription model because of that. So I think these people who are on a mission and are educating people is so important and effective to be really building a captive audience and supporters and advocates who can help push that movement forward.
Which leads me to my final question, which you may have already answered, but in your opinion, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
I'll answer slightly differently, I think, because this is based on our experience of just observing so many entrepreneurs and having such kind of close proximity to them. I think it's the founder. I think it's the people and their mindset behind the businesses is what is the most clear indicator of whether they are going to go on to succeed and innovate and have an impact on the wider world. People always say there's no such thing as a new idea. And I think ultimately, if you have an amazing concept, a totally unique concept, if you have a delicious product, if you have a really distinctive brand, of course, those things help. But the best predictor of what's actually going to succeed is the approach, the mindset, and the philosophy of the people behind it. And when I say founder, I'm cautious. It's not just the founder. I don't necessarily believe in this like cult of the founder. I think it's the people that founder brings in to the organization they work with as well. For us, generally, the businesses that we're working with are solo founders or very small founder-led teams. But I think as teams grow, in continuing to maintain that culture in the organization is crucial. But I think that's what it comes down to, really. It's like the determination, the resilience, the willingness to learn and change and adapt and deal with uncertainties. If there's anything the last few years have shown us, it's that the world is very unpredictable, and the ability to respond, all of those things, the ability to build authentic relationships with people, with your customers or with partners or with suppliers, all of those things really just come down to the mindset and personality and approach of the founder and the people around them. So I think that's the real answer to what makes a brand likely to be one that's going to have an impact in the future.
Great answer. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.